You are now listening to the Photography Enthusiast Podcast. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Photography Enthusiast Podcast. As always, I am your host, Daniel Lee, or Photos by DOW. Now this week, we're going to be talking about must-have items for long exposures, going over a few, you know, interesting news topics and talking about what I've been up to. As always, to start off with my personal updates and what I've been up to. Haven't really been shooting outdoors still yet, you know, very close to that. We're getting our Freedom Day, meant to be around 11th October, so pretty close, you know, so I can travel hopefully outside my 5 kilometer zone by then. Otherwise, you know, when we go for our daily walks, me and my girlfriend just exercising, I've been, you know, scouting locations that I can do cityscapes from, pretty much both with the gear I have now and when I get my RF 16mm. There's definitely a lot of spots I want to shoot with the 16mm, especially around, say, Circular Quay, that kind of stuff. Still trying to find some more higher up locations I can shoot from because I like the higher up view, but I feel like Sydney's kind of flat in that sense. There isn't heaps of elevation. Not anywhere too close to the city anyway. I think if you go like Blue Mountains, you obviously got higher up there, but I'm not going to drive all that way. Not my type of thing. I also kind of want to go to the place called Bald Hill Lookout. I went there a long time ago, middle of the day, just to like look around, thought we could swim in that, but not my, you know, the water's meant to be quite dangerous as well, and both my girlfriend and I are not strong swimmers. I'm pretty bad swimmer, and she's like, only knows doggy paddle. So, you know, it's not exactly the best idea for us to be swimming out there. Otherwise, I do really want to go one time for a sunset shoot there, because it's beautiful. Would love to be able to go there with a drone, but obviously I'd need to buy a drone. And the one that I really want right now is the Mavic, well, not really want, but the one that I would buy if I had the money would be the Mavic Air 2S. That one has a 1-inch sensor, meant to be a lot better in terms of image quality. All the photos I've seen from it look really good as well. I don't know when I'll buy a drone. I feel like the stage I'm at now with my lenses, there's nothing I could really do to add on to my lens kit. Like, I still really want 135mm, and the main choice now, I feel like, would be the Sigma 135mm Art in EF mount and just adapt it. In saying that, I don't really see the point in a way. Like, I don't do portraits, well, at the moment anyway, so that's, to me, what the lens would really excel at. That and street photography. That street photography for that would be amazing, but that's another thing I don't really do anymore. So if I was to get it, what is the point? Landscapes, you know, I feel like primes are a bit harder to use for landscapes when it comes to that longer distance because I don't want to crop too much. That's where I do prefer the 100, the 400. At the most, I could just see myself replacing my current gear for newer versions. So for example, if the 100 to 400 RF lens turns out to be really good image quality wise once there's actual reviews for it, then I'll probably 100% maybe be selling my Sigma for that, my Tamron for that. Not making the judgment too soon because I am happy with the Tamron, but I feel, you know, sharpness could always be a bit better, that kind of stuff. I do like the fact that my Tamron has the tripod collar as well, so, and it's a bit faster aperture-wise as well. 2/3 of a stop, I believe, because mine's f6.3 on the long end. So you got f7.1, then f8, so yeah, 2/3 of a stop. Otherwise, you know, maybe when there's, who knows what Canon will release in the future. If they did like a 85-1.4, which was quite small, I doubt it would be, but if it was non-L, like a non-L 85-1.4, nice and small, but decent image quality and light, 100%, you know, I'd probably be going for that. The same goes for a 35. Although with 35, I don't feel like I gain much by going to f1.4 compared to f1.8, but, you know, who knows? Have to see when it happens, if that kind of lens releases, but we'll soon know. There is a rumor, not so much a rumor, Canon have registered another lens with overseas authorities or whatever, so we'll probably get a new Canon lens announcement soon. What that lens will be, who knows? I know Canon rumors guessed that it's the 35 1.2, so if we do that does come out, I'd be curious to see what it's like. For me, I'm not big on the f1.2 lens. I would prefer they do smaller lenses, but in saying that, if the f1.2 are the pricey ones, are the L lenses, and then they make 35, 50, and 85 f1.4 lenses that are around like 1200 to 1500 AUD, so maybe, I don't know, probably like $1000 USD or somewhere around there, but they're really good eye image quality, nano USM motors, so not that annoying STM, and, you know, small and light, but they're obviously maybe not as good a build as an L quality lens, and 100% I really hope they go for that, but obviously all speculation, all guessing, and all wishes as well. Been doing a bit of shooting at home. I just took, you know, photos of stuff I had, like a Nandoroid, some cards I had, like Nendoroid, not Nendoroids, blackjack cards, that sort of stuff, you know. Nothing really major. Just been eagerly awaiting that 16mm to release so I can really go out and shoot pretty much anything with that. Already been scouting locations as I do my walk, as I mentioned, so once I get the lens, I'll know exactly where to shoot straight away. Also, at the time of release, I'll be getting my second jab of Pfizer, so I'm hoping not to get sick after that. The first jab, you know, had a sore arm for like half a week, so I couldn't really work out properly, so that was very annoying and frustrating. I was like going crazy not being able to exercise, so really, you know, touch wood, don't get sick. Just a sore arm and that's it, hopefully anyway. I also got a new game for anyone interested. It's called Kena: Bridge of Spirits, which it's like really, really good game. It's an indie game, not so much indie, but it's not like a major developer. It was only released digitally. But if you're into games, you like something with a pretty decent story and nice gameplay, you have a PS5 or a PC or PS4, definitely give it a try. It's such a good game. They usually do animation only and not games. So if you're familiar with, say, like Raya and the Last Dragon, that kind of look, when you look at the visuals for the game, it looks like a Pixar kind of game. I mean, movie. But it's actually a game and it's amazing, trust me. Watch a few gameplay videos if you're not convinced, but definitely, definitely worth trying. It's their first game too, so it's really great effort for that. Well, that's it for my personal update, so now we're onto the news. So for the first story, it's about a photographer who sold their widely stolen photo as an NFT, a non-fungible token, for $300,000. So one photographer constantly had her photo infringed on, but has now come to, she's pretty much got the last laugh of sorts, so she had a photo of this road in Hawaii and you had like a volcano sort in the background, all the nice lush green trees. It was a really nice image, but constantly being stolen and infringed on. People were posting it on Reddit, posting it everywhere. She even tried to find some services, you know, like you can pay. There's a few ones that'll track down people infringing on your items so that you can try and take legal action against them, which she did, but she never got a cent out of it and never had any luck with stopping them. Then, as you know, in the last 6 months, a lot more photographers have been getting into NFTs and the NFT space. So that's something she apparently decided to give it a try. So Simrad, so last name, decided to mint a single edition NFT of that particular image, which she, rather than setting a price for it, she went to auction and apparently ended up selling for 100 Ethereum, which pretty much came out to about $300,000, I'm assuming US dollars, with one bid only. That's obviously an insane amount to sell a photo for, especially one that's so shared so publicly online. And I know some people don't really see the value of NFTs and understand why or where they get their value from. Most simplest way of describing is that it's like you're signing an edition of that and giving them ownership of it. Even though they don't have ownership to recreate and sell it or whatever, and you still own full copyright, you know, options of it, they're pretty much getting a genuine copy that's signed by you to say they officially own it. And that's where the money comes in. So to the average person, it may not seem like it's worth it, but to someone who, like, you know, likes to collect art and that kind of stuff, they probably see a benefit from it and they can appreciate it in that sense, which obviously is a good thing for us. Once the auction concluded and that was sold, she actually made the photo available for free in full resolution, which you can download. There's even a link in the article for that. In terms of if it's worth trying to sell your photos as NFTs, could probably do a full episode on it, really diving into it, but my friend Joey of LastLights.net, he just did a blog post about NFTs, might be worth checking out as well. I'll actually link it in the show notes. But otherwise, to me, I don't see it as a high risk thing. I actually, you know, listed a few of my photos for sales in NFT. So what I did was, and if you're interested in doing it, first you need to find somewhere to sell them. So for example, I'm using OpenSea. Now, no affiliation to any of this stuff, kind of stuff. So don't worry, I'm not making money off this by telling you. This is just simply what I use. You can use your own choice. What you do is you go to OpenSea. I think you create an account by connecting a wallet. If you don't have your own crypto wallet, which one is best for you, I don't know. I personally use Coinbase over the one that they recommended off OpenSea purely because I don't think the one they recommended, I forgot the name of it now, would allow me to add stuff or, you know, convert my stuff from AUD. It would be USD only, which is more of a hassle because then I lose money on conversion. And then when I convert, I lose more money as well from the gas fee. So it just wasn't worth it for me. So I went for Coinbase. So pretty much you do that. You connect it to that and then you have your account. So when you want to mint, pretty much minting is, you know, like making your first official thing, creating it for sale. Once you mint your first NFT, you have to pay a gaslight fee, which is just, think of it as like an account opening fee. You know, when you join the gym, that kind of stuff, you pay an opening account opening fee. It's the same as minting an NFT. You pay that fee. How much that is depends on where you are, your currency, all that kind of stuff, what time of day as well. Because depending on how busy the miners are, is how much that fee will be. So I think I paid around 130 AUD. You just pretty much look at how much you need, buy that much in Ethereum on your wallet, and then transfer it over. And yeah, that's pretty much easiest. I did manage to mess it up, so you have to be careful. I didn't lose any money, but I ended up buying double. So rather than buy, say, $130 AUD worth of Ethereum, which is how much I needed to do the transaction, I ended up doing it twice. So I got extra Ethereum in my wallet, which is nothing bad. You know, I could always withdraw all if I want, but hopefully I sell some NFTs and I'll withdraw all at once. But yeah, otherwise it's a fairly easy process. If you can afford that $130, I don't think it's much of a risk. You know, that's why I did it. Even if no one buys it, you know, oh well. Hopefully someone would buy my stuff. That money would likely go back to camera gear. Previously, I was thinking more purely a GPU, but I don't think GPU anymore. I think I mentioned last episode I was GPU. My mind's already changed by now. Now I think I want a drone. I want the Mavic Air 2S. That would be great to own. Although in Sydney, they're a bit more strict with where you can fly it. They're not too strict and can easily go to the coastal areas, especially like that place I mentioned, Bald Hill Lookout, and fly it there. Who knows, might even get a bit more into video in that sense if I did, because, you know, the video is for drone, but oh well. Next up, a photographer goes viral for deleting wedding photos in front of the groom. So this one is very interesting. Now, this apparently as well started out as a post on Reddit. There's a woman who is a dog groomer. Now, she sometimes photographs her dog clients' dogs for her Instagram and Facebook accounts and posts them on there. She was apparently invited to a friend's wedding. Then, you know, she registered in that, set a meal, all that kind of stuff. But then she was asked to photograph it instead. Now, the couple said they were sort of tight on cash and, you know, didn't have much to spend. Because they were friends, she agreed to do it for her friend's rate and the couple, which was $250 for a 10-hour event, which is very, very cheap for such a long event. I think, you know, most of the time you'd be paying a few grand for a wedding photographer, not 250. Even like a cheap one would be 500. So the fact that she would do it for that amount shows how, you know, very nice of her it was to do that. Now, on the day, apparently she was driving around with the bride to take photos at all different locations, and the reception, you know, is where things started to go wrong. Apparently she started working at 11 a.m. and was meant to go through to 7 p.m. But then at 5 p.m. the food was being served, which she was told there was no spot for her and she wasn't allowed to stop to eat. Apparently the venue was very old and hot. It was around 110 degrees Fahrenheit. No idea how hot that is because we use Celsius here in Australia. I'm guessing it's like 40 degrees, somewhere around there. Just a rough guess. And she was getting quite tired. So she told the groom, you know, I just need to take a quick 20 minute break and eat and have a drink of water, as she had two water bottles, which were both empty. But the groom informed her that she's there to work and she can either do that or she can leave without pay. So she was originally a guest, and as I mentioned, an RSVP'd and selected a meal, but apparently as soon as she became the photographer, this was taken away. So she asked the groom, obviously at this stage, you know, she'd been working from 11 to 5, 6 hours with no, just that little bit of water, nothing to eat. So she was tired, frustrated, you know, just wanted a 20 minute break. Didn't even expect them to pay for food, just wanted that break to be able to have some water and have something to eat, which is more than reasonable. So she asked here the groom, if he was sure about what he said, that, you know, she's either fired or she can keep working. He replied yes, so she pulled up her camera and apparently deleted all the photos in front of him and then left. Apparently in terms of this post, most people were in overwhelming support of the photographer, and I personally, I would be too. Like, it's very, you know, you're already, someone's doing a favor to you by photographing your wedding for such a small amount and you still take advantage, won't even allow them to have water or food. If that was a normal employer, say she worked at wherever, in Walmart, an office, bank, wherever, they'd be, you know, pretty much in a lot of trouble. They could lose their job. The business could be fined by Fair Work because of that. So it's more than reasonable for her to just have something quickly to eat and drink. I got friends, you know, who do weddings. I even done one myself. And the one I was at, I was unpaid. I wasn't just there as a second shooter to see if I'd be able to do weddings full time, or, you know, not full time, but, you know, on weekends, that kind of stuff. Even I got my own meal provided. They asked me what I want. I got my choice. I got my steak. I got to sit down and eat when everyone else was eating, because no one likes the photo of them while they're eating, you know, like people just want to eat in peace, that sort of thing. So that's usually when the photographers would actually get their break, which they didn't want her to have, which was very, very unreasonable. So do I think the photos being deleted was harsh? To be honest, no, I don't think it was harsh in my opinion, mainly because if she's not being paid for the event, why would she hand over those photos? That money was in exchange for the images. If she's not being paid, she has no obligation or no reason to hand them over. And then if she kept them and then tried to say ransom them, if you guys don't pay me, I'm not going to give you these photos, then she'd look more like the bad guy at the same time. Personally, you know, yeah, she could have done that. At least kept them in case like the bride, maybe she's more friends with the bride, wanted the photos later. And she could probably recover them using software as well, as people did mention in the article, in the comments. But I don't think, you know, she should let them push her around like that. I think she made the right choice, but that's just me. Maybe I'm a bit more harsh in that sense. And the last one, just a quick one, Canon can meet demand for R3 or new lenses. Now, pretty much every manufacturer says this. Canon, Nikon, Sony, no matter who releases new gear, you know, orders have exceeded expectation. We're unable to fill them, that kind of stuff. In this case, Canon Japan has published an apology that now includes 17 total products that received more orders than expected and will be in short supply globally. The statement they issued pretty much said, "We have received more orders than expected for each of the following products, and it will take some time before delivery. We thank you for many orders and apologize for any convenience caused to our customers. Thank you kindly, look forward to your understanding." There are quite a lot of items. So we have the 100-500 f4.5 to 7.1 IS, the RF 100 macro, the RF 400 2.8 LIS, the RF 400 600mm, the ring type tripod mount, the RF 14-5L, the R3, whole bunch of accessories like eye cup, strap, that kind of stuff, lens hood, all the accessories for the R3, like their multi-accessory shoe adapter, speedlight transmitter, as well as the RF 100 to 400 and the 16mm f2.8. Apparently they're meant to have a release date of, or shipping date of October 14th, but it's quite unlikely based on the fact that, you know, all these delays, which is kind of sad for me because I really want my 16mm, but you know, it is what it is. There's so many delays on everything. Like I mentioned with GPUs, they're really hard to get, and until this chip shortage fixes itself sort of thing or balances out, we won't get correct supplies. So it could be quite a while and quite a wait, but oh well, you know, not much we can do. But you know, people sort of go on about how manufacturers always say this, but they're not going to say that, oh yeah, no one wants our stuff and then we don't have any stock of it. Of course they're going to say that, you know, because technically they expect say 5 orders, but then people ordered 7, there's 7 orders. You've exceeded expectation. So it's not hard to exceed expectation of how many units, but at the same time, from what I've seen online, the 16mm seems like a lens that every single person will own that owns an RF body. And the 100 to 400 seems quite popular as well. You got the few that sort of expect it to be an f4 to f5.6, which weighs like 600 grams like it does now, but only costs like, you know, $500 kind of thing, when it's not going to be like that. You're either going to get a fast lens, the big, heavy and expensive, or a light lens that's slower. Can't have both ways. Well, not with current, you know, technology. That's pretty much it for the news, so on to the main topic. Long exposures. Now, these are probably my favorite type of genre of photography, something I really like to do, and they're probably one thing that really interested me when I was just first learning photography, because to me they give a very different look, especially something more artistic in a way. I love how they convey motion and, you know, just have a very different look to the sky and the water. Just has a, you know, very just pleasant in general. I even sometimes feel like if I take photos of water and there's, you know, no long exposure, it just looks weird to see water frozen in certain situations. When it comes to a definition, like how long a long exposure needs to be, or exposure needs to be a long exposure, there's no real sort of set rule or anything. I'd say anything that has motion in it, you know, say like a second or longer kind of thing, could be defined as a long exposure. I think when I first started, that's what I used to always read, that anything of 1 second or longer. So I guess you could call that a long exposure. But you know, you usually see them with stuff like cityscapes, landscapes. You don't often see long exposures outside of that genre, but it really comes down to what you're shooting. So because, you know, I do enjoy doing them, I thought it'd be good to go over what you need to be able to do these if you've never tried them before and there's something you're wanting to try, or something you do occasionally and wondering if there's any way you could, you know, do them a bit better. So what I would do firstly is, in terms of camera-wise, it doesn't matter too much. You do really want something, you know, if you're really going to go that far, something you can control manually. I wouldn't personally never consider a phone for a long exposure. Even if you could sort of lock it down on a tripod, I still probably wouldn't use a phone no matter which phone it is. For me, it's like, has to be something that can control manual, and you'd really ideally want something that has bulb mode. So if you don't know what bulb mode is, on most cameras, you have your minimum shutter speed. It can go the maximum shutter speed. So it's usually say 1/4000 or 1/8000 of a second to 30 seconds. With bulb mode, it lets you go longer than 30 seconds. So, you know, obviously you can do up to 30 seconds. Say you don't want have a camera without bulb mode, but it can do exposures up to 30 seconds. Then that would be fine. You can just do that. You can just use filters to sort of control the exposure length. So that way you can still get a nice looking image, but stay within that 30 seconds. Otherwise, I'd say there's about four really essential things that I'd see you need to have to do long exposures, which I personally pretty much always use. So I thought I'd go over them now. So the first one is a sturdy tripod. So you've got no idea how much this is probably the most important thing. If you could only choose one thing on this list, this would be it, because I think my voice just cracked a bit, but this would be it. So I personally have two tripods. I have a Suray R2204. This one's is a bit bigger one. It's a carbon fiber one. I believe it's actually discontinued now. You can't buy it anymore. So, you know, if you're thinking of buying the same one as me, it's probably not a good idea. It's a good tripod, but I think it was replaced by another model. I would say, you know, there's certain things I don't like about it in comparison to my old Manfrotto. Although it doesn't really affect long exposures, it does have a center column, which it's not a bad thing, but with my Manfrotto, with the center column, you could pull it up and then put the column to the side and pull the head up that way. So that way you could go flat on the ground. Whereas this one, you can't actually do that. I think you can technically turn it upside down or something, hang it a different way, but it just doesn't work as well. And I've never really given it a try either. So, because you know, I like to shoot at quite low angles sometimes. So when I do that, that's when I have to use my other tripod, which doesn't have a center column. Obviously, if you're wondering what the point of center column is, the main point of it is so you can go higher. So you put the legs as far as you can. And if you still need to go higher, that's when you start extending the center column. But especially for something like long exposures, if you do extend that center column, it often won't be as stable. So you might have more movement, which, you know, obviously is a bad thing. So that's another thing to think about. So if you're looking at a tripod, one that has a center column and one that doesn't, I would personally go for the one without the center column, assuming it's, you know, decent height still. If you want to, this is from what I've read, from what I know, carbon fiber has less vibrations than aluminium. It's going to be more expensive and lighter, but less vibrations because it soaked them up more compared to aluminium. If you could only afford one, I would probably just go for a good quality travel tripod. As you know, they can often be quite stable. So as I mentioned, I got two. The Suray T025X, that's my travel tripod. Now, it won't go as high as my R2204 and it might not be able to support as much weight, but I've never had an issue with it. I was a bit skeptical of how stable it would be. But I remember when I went on my trip to Singapore, I was on this wooden bridge in Gardens by the Bay, and I was trying to do a long exposure of night of Marina Bay Sands. Now, I thought, you know, being that people are running on this bridge, walking on this bridge, that kind of stuff, there's no way I could get a steady exposure. And my camera didn't have IBIS back then either. My lens had IS, but I turned that off because you're meant to when you're another thing, make sure to turn your IS off when you're doing it. But pretty much I did that, and I was wondering why, you know, take my photo, and I was so shocked because the photo was actually still sharp. And this is just a travel tripod. This, I believe you can buy it now for like $299 AUD anyway. So it's not expensive. There's a few Manfrotto ones as well. What is it called? Benro do a travel tripod as well. So if you're going to buy one, you can only afford one, definitely go for the travel one, I would say, because you can use it for both scenarios. It's not too heavy to carry around with you. They're usually quite small, like mine fits in my backpack, so I can take it anywhere with me when I travel. You can also do something like a clamp. I know my friend Joey, when he does his long exposures, depending on what location he visits, he uses a clamp. I personally have never used a clamp. I think with a lot of locations I visit, a clamp wouldn't be possible because there's no rail. But if you're somewhere that, you know, has a rail, or the locations you like to shoot often do have rails, that may be an option for you. You also got your GorillaPods. I've never done a long exposure or anything using them, so I can't say how good or reliable they be, but supporting weight, stability, that kind of thing. But otherwise, number one, steady tripod has to be a must for you. The next one isn't a must, but it can definitely help, which would be ND filters. So neutral density filters, depending on the strength, block light from coming into your camera, which can extend your exposure. I did a whole episode on this, which you can go back and listen to if you want to know it more in detail. I personally recommend square filters. I would never recommend circular. Main reason is I found with square filters, number one, you have less vignetting on them. Even if you like the vignette, you're better off not having it than adding it in later than being stuck with it. Because, you know, when you do brighten it up, you're losing detail in those corners. Sometimes, you know, depending on how strong it is with your filter, can go in and cover most of the image. I remember I had a BMW, I think it was BW, 10-stop filter, and that one would, you know, majority of the image would be a vignette because it was that strong on that. Because, you know, some lenses, they already vignette in the corners, and if your filter does it as well, it's going to create more of issues. So that's number one reason why. And number two, with square filters, you get, say, a 100mm system. Now, rather than buy one, so say, you know, you have four lenses, for example, one is 67mm filter thread, one's 77, one's 82, and one's like 52. If you're buying circular filters, you'd either need to buy a filter for each lens, or you could just buy one 82mm filter and a step down ring, which is another way of doing it. But whereas with square filters, it's kind of like the step down ring in a sense where you just have the different rings you buy, you attach it to your lens, and then just attach the holder to that. Pretty much that's it. So one filter for every single lens you want. It's that easy. Otherwise, it really does come down to what you prefer. Sometimes, you know, I feel like the results and quality are better with a square, but there's a lot of people that get great quality and great results from their circular. So as I mentioned, it's just really up to you, and it's up to you how quickly you can put them on and take them off. I always used to find it such a hassle taking the circular ones off because you don't want to put them on too lightly so there's any light leak or they move around during exposure. But whereas with the square ones, because the holder, you just quickly unclip it, take it off, you can change filters, put it back, clip it back on, that's it. Especially if you want to change your metering, figure out what your exposure is without the filter. I found it a lot easier with square, so that's why I'd still say square is the best to go with. I personally use the Nissi V6. I really like this holder. It was a few hundred, but it's definitely worth it because it's the holder itself, plus it's got the most common adapter rings. I think it was like 67, 77, and 72mm all included. So, you know, that already good there. And it also comes with a really good pro circular polarizer filter, which is really good and built into the holder. So you can sort of circulate. You can obviously remove it if you don't want to use that for that image, but pretty much use it every single time. I would just, yeah, personally always go for those. It's sort of like an investment. These things will last you a long time. It's not something that you would need to get rid of anytime soon. And depending on what square filters you get, you can sometimes use different brands. Like I have Haider square filters that I'm using with the Nissi holder and I have no issue. But it's not, I don't believe it's the same for all. Sometimes the thickness can be an issue, but so you just need to look into that, research that first before you go ahead. The next item is a remote trigger. So when it comes to a remote trigger, this one is really dependent on your camera and how long the exposure you're going to do. So if you're going over 30 seconds, that's where the trigger comes in. Now, if you have a Canon camera, especially one that's been in recent years, I think anything since the 5D4 onwards, you will not need one. Because on Canon cameras, and I think some other brands like Olympus and that, I'm not sure about Fuji, I think Fuji has it as well, you have something called a bulb timer. This is like a game changer for long exposure. So what it is if I want to shoot a 2-minute exposure on, say, my old Sony A7 Mark III, the way I would have to do it is trigger the exposure with my remote, and then when I'm ready to stop the exposure, I'd have to stop it again with my remote. So I'd have to be paying attention to how long the exposure is for. Whereas on my Canon with the bulb timer, on the camera, I can just set, I want, you know, a 2-minute, 4-minute, however, 2-hour, 5-hour exposure, however long I want, I can set it on the camera. Now, you know, even if you want to, say, trigger the camera so you're not touching it, so you don't create vibrations, you can do that as well. So all you would do is set a 2-second timer on the camera, and in addition to the bulb timer. So after 2 seconds, it triggers the bulb, and then you just do whatever you want, go on your phone, relax. At the end of the exposure, it'll automatically stop it for you, which is honestly so good. Since I, you know, got this camera, I barely use the trigger if I go out to take photos. I don't even have to worry about forgetting about it. If you want to do some kind of landscape shot of you in the photo, that's where the trigger may help more because, you know, say you can focus on yourself as well as triggering the photo and stopping it. You could still use a bulb timer in that sense if you're doing like some artistic long exposure of yourself and trying to stay as still as possible, but it just sort of comes down to what you want to create. But you could also use your phone using the app to trigger it. But for me, I personally don't like doing that because you have to keep your phone awake so it doesn't time out, disconnect from that. You can sometimes have signal interferences. Bluetooth can be annoying as well and laggy when you're using that. I think it's more to do with the phone and interfering with signals because I have a Bluetooth trigger, which is called the BRE1 for Canon. I believe it's BRE1 and that one works perfectly. Otherwise, you know, you can also get ones off eBay. They're usually IR remotes. You have to make sure your body has an infrared sensor. So for example, my R6 has an infrared sensor. So I've been using the same infrared remote for so long. Whereas with the Canon M50 Mark II, for some weird reason, it doesn't have an IR sensor. It can only use Bluetooth. So that's why I ended up getting the Bluetooth remote. Then the last one is a ND timer app. Now this one, I guess if you're really good with maths, you could do that as well. And there's a few charts that show you. But what you do is, I believe the one I use is called ND Timer. That's on iOS. I don't know if they're also on Android or not. I'm sure there'd be like another version on there. Pretty much you put on your base exposure. So what your base exposure is, you know, you set your shutter speed, set your aperture, set your ISO. So say I'm shooting at f8 ISO 100 and my exposure without any filter on it is 1/20th of a second. Then you go in the app and you select how many filters you're using. So usually a CPL is around one stop. So I put one stop as filter one. And then for filter two, I put a 10 stop filter. So then it tells me I need an exposure of 1:42 to get, you know, the proper exposure. This obviously saves a lot of hassle of working out the maths of 10 stops, that kind of stuff. And I wouldn't say it's 100% accurate every time. Sometimes it can come out a little bit underexposed, a little bit overexposed. Don't know if it's just because of the app or because, you know, light can change while you're doing that long exposure. So because of that, you know, it may be a bit off, but at least it gives you a bit of a leeway. You do that, say, you know, it says 1:40. You can take the photo with that, see how it looks, then adjust it. Say it's a bit overexposed, 1:20 or 1 minute. Underexposed, 2.5 minutes kind of thing. You can just adjust it as you need it. But it's definitely something good to, you know, get an idea of what kind of length exposure you want. I know this, that's it for the tips. I know some people, they like to take multiple exposures. They'll take like 50 photos or 100 photos, like 2 second exposures or 1 second exposure, that kind of thing, and merge them somehow in Photoshop to make them into a long exposure. I personally haven't done that. I like the old way. I like to do as much as I can in camera and not have to do that much in Photoshop and for long exposures. I like the look of it purely in camera, but if you prefer that, you find that easier, you know, it's up to you. I know the older Sony bodies, the second gen ones, like your A7R Mark II, A7 II, they had the Play Memories apps where you could install them on your camera to be able to do that all in camera. But yeah, for me, it's always in proper long exposures. So I hope these tips help someone out there. If they did, make sure to reach out, let me know. Otherwise, that's pretty much it for this episode. If you'd like to follow me, see my personal photography, that will be at photosbydlee.com or at photosbydlee on Twitter. If you want to listen to previous episodes, you can see the link to my website, the Photography Enthusiast website, in the show notes. Otherwise, the photographyenthusiast.com. That's it for this episode. I'll be back in a fortnight with who knows what, because I do not have a clue right now. Maybe the 50mm RF 50mm review is pretty much done, actually, to be honest. I don't know if I want to add a few more photos, but I could probably release a review for that very soon. Might do it as a bonus episode, might do it in place of the podcast 1 week, but we'll see how we go. Otherwise, thank you for listening. Take care. See ya.